Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
November's here and investors cheer. However, market's looking a little frothy as a fear and greed index tops 91. And our guest today is Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. All this and much more on episode number 636 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me each and every week. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host. I'm also the founder of Horowitz & Company, where we have a multitude of strategies for investors to invest according to whatever particular risk time horizon that you have. And of course, we're always welcoming new money. So if you have a desire, if you like what we're talking about, you like the concepts, the strategies, and our outlook, well, maybe it's something for you. Check it out. Go over to the Disciplined Investor .com, and you'll find out all the information you need on each of the strategies, whether it's the Investology, our robo-esque type of strategy, which blends a, well, I call it an advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced strategy platform, or the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, which is a long-short strategy, and global allocations. Well, as you know, we haven't had a guest on for a while, so I thought we'd spend a good amount of time with our friend Frank Curzio, because Frank does bring a good amount of information, talks about a lot of stocks, and I thought we would really focus in on some of those. And he promises, when I talked to him earlier, to bring a surprise, well-known, popular stock as a short position. So this is something I want to get into. So without any further ado, how about we get right to our guest and see what he has to say. And here we are with our friend today, Frank Curzio. Now, we haven't had guests on for some time, and I thought, you know what? Let's bring back somebody who really has their hands all the way in up to their elbows in the markets to understand a little bit more about what's going on with the current conditions, economics, individual stocks, and who better than do it than Frank Curzio. Frank, what's happening?
Wow, you're talking about me there? That's pretty cool. Thanks, man.
Frank Curzio. This is Frank Curzio, right?
Yes, today I'm Frank Curzio.
How are you feeling? I know you had that hip surgery done and all that. How's it going?
I had hip replacement surgery, and I'm actually on treadmills right now. I only needed a walker for one day and was walking on my own. So, yeah, things are good. I mean, look, I'm young, so it was a quick recovery period, but it's unbelievable because I was in so much pain before. And I'm doing well, though. Thanks for asking, buddy.
That's good. Very good. So let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the markets. I mean, aside from the fact that we are getting blitzed by headlines each and every day, multiple times of the day, that are conflicting, confirming, then conflicting the confirming, and confirming the conflicting. I mean, you know, what's happening? I mean, markets are hitting all-time highs. We got the Dow Jones Industrial Average, S&P 500, the NASDAQ. Small caps are lagging a bit, but it almost seems like there is this gravity-defying process that's going on right now that has markets really continuing to elevate regardless of the news. So what is it? Is it the Fed? Is it the hope? What's going on?
It's a low interest rate environment, and there's not too many places to put your money to earn a good return. So you're looking overseas where nothing's really working. You're starting to see that stabilize a little bit. But if you're looking at where you want to place your money, any place in the world right now, it's the U.S. stocks. They're not crazy expensive. They're not cheap, but they're not crazy expensive, especially in relation to interest rates, where, you know, we'll be trading about 16 and a half, 17 times forward earnings, which is the five-year average is about 16.5, the 10 years about 16 point whatever. So, which means you're going to be able to find some really good stocks that are trading at 12, 13 times earnings. I mean, you know, you look 6 months ago, only 6 months ago, Intel was 46, 45, and it's 58 today. This is a stock that's trading at 11 times forward earnings, dividend, getting into the right markets. I mean, there's a lot of good ideas out there. And you know, you're seeing a lot of money coming to the U.S. markets, but it's expected. I mean, low interest rate environment, we have our policy, or, you know, President Trump's policy and his bellwether of how the economy is doing is the S&P 500. So every time everything goes on with trade, going out there saying, oh, it's good. It's, you know, so, I mean, we just have so many things that are influencing stocks right now. And there's not a lot of place to put your money, especially earn a yield. And, you know, for me, this is something that I've been predicting for a while. I still think stocks going to go a lot higher until election, although we are a little, overbought here, I think, by numerous indicators. So we could see a little bit of a pullback, but overall going to the election, I think we're still going to continue this trend.
So let's just take that entire conversation, break it down to the first thing you talked about was the idea that the forward PE is 16, 17, give or take, which is in line with historical averages. We're trading at about, I think, 22 on trailing. But, you know, one of the things that goes into the idea of calculating a forward PE ratio is the estimates, right? So Our estimates at this point, what that means is that estimates are either too low right now, and that's why we're getting, how is it that, you know, that we can rely on this? Because what we've seen historically over the last couple of years is that analysts have been all the way out on the curve, estimating, you know, earnings on a company much higher. And then as we get closer and closer into the time when the company reports, well, what do we know? They drop their numbers and miraculously the company beats by 2 cents. I mean, that's been the playbook, right?
Yeah. I mean, Apple, if you take away that and buybacks, I mean, you're looking at most companies missing their earnings estimates. I mean, Apple would have missed almost every single earning estimate going back 5 quarters. It always gets lowered into the quarter. They're buying back a ton of stock, just the shares outstanding. But with that said, you're still seeing earnings growth. And as long as we have that,
hold it.
Well, let me finish.
Okay. All right.
Before you jump on. Yeah. So earnings growth, what I mean, because you talk about forward estimates, where right now, year over year, we're down a little bit on earnings. But remember, last year was tax reforms. It's hard comparisons. But The next year, they're predicting 10% growth in earnings, which I think is crazy. But even at 5 or 6 or 7% is going to be very, very good. We're still seeing earnings growth with a low interest rate environment at 17 PE. Although right now, the quarterly growth, if you look year over year, is down. But it's not going to be that way a year from now. I mean, even if estimates are going to come down and they're not going to show 10% growth, which they're projecting right now, the analysts, for next year. But it will probably see about 5, 6, 7% growth.
Before we go on, I want to make sure I give you a proper introduction, by the way. Frank Curzio is with Frank Curzio Research, and tell them where, first of all, they could see all your stuff before I get too caught up in a heated discussion with you.
Oh, I appreciate that. So you can go to CurzioResearch.com. We have a lot of free stuff. I think we probably have, when it comes to financial newsletter publishing industry, I write several newsletters. We probably have more free content than anyone out there. And the reason why is because we want to introduce people to us, right? I mean, when we started this company, I started a company 3 years ago. It's easy to focus on the people that have been a part of this and know you and know your company, especially me. I've been in this industry for over 25 years. But people who haven't, right, they want to get to know you, where we have a lot of free services and they get research. We have low price newsletters. And of course, we have premium services. But all that's available on CurzioResearch.com if you go there and take a look.
All right. Perfect. Now back to.
Thanks for that.
Back to on earnings growth and the expectation that analysts have, once again, of a 10% earnings growth. Therefore, that's why we're seeing that there is a forward PE a little bit lighter than maybe it should be. But OK. But what about the idea that we are going to see a 5% growth potentially on a year-over-year basis? And I do tend to agree with you that this is a much harder quarter. There was a couple of these compared to previous year-ago quarters due to the fact that we had this great tax benefit.
But put that in perspective, because usually if we're growing earnings like 8%, that would be great. They grew 20% year-over-year.
Right.
So it was crazy.
Right.
So that's the comparisons. When we say comparisons, you're comparing it to last year where – if you compare last year to the previous year, it's 20% earnings growth. Now it's a little bit lower, but we're expected 10% going forward.
And with all due respect, we're also playing some catch up because the last quarter of the year, we saw stocks drop anywhere from 15 to 20%, depending on what index you're looking at. So what happened is the part of this year to catch up to that, you got to gain, you know, a good amount of money to catch up to that level again. But what I'm saying to you is that how is it, aside from buybacks, listen, recently Goldman Sachs came out with a study. And they said that next year they believe that the market's going to continue rolling higher. And one of the reasons is that they see three incremental buyers of stocks. First, being corporate buybacks. Second, being foreigners and foreign entities. And third, being retail. The buybacks are going to be $470 billion. And between retail and foreign, it's going to be about $80 billion. So, I mean, is it that we are in an environment that this is nonstop because it's good for the, listen, it's good for options, grants, and for companies then to make sure they don't dilute their shares into that. Management wants to keep stock prices up because it's good for them and it's good for their investors. But let's be honest, it's good for them, which is fine. And that we have buybacks that are going on and low interest rates. I mean, is that really what we're talking about here? Because if you look at really the world, it's hard to imagine that we are going to break out into another growth spree around the world, considering all the things that are going on and considering just the tools that were utilized to try to get us out of this.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of good points. And I think we like to generalize, even myself, when we say the markets, right? The markets. But you know what? I believe stocks are going to move higher. And there's been a lot of concentration. We're probably about 13, 14 stocks that are really moving this market higher. You know, when I look longer term over the next year or two, which, you know, that let's say that's long term for now. That's short term for some people, long term for others. But I just see where we have companies and we have earnings growth where it's not going to be every single company going higher. What I've seen in the last two quarters especially is a lot of separation where you're not seeing every company go up in every single sector that's positive and every go like mining and minerals, all of them go down. You're seeing separation. You're seeing some of the big say the mining industry is the worst industry, right? It's been the worst industry since 2012, one of them. But you're seeing some separation. Yeah, gold prices have come back a little bit, but you're seeing the royalty companies do good.
Look at Kirkland Lake. We own that, and that's been just an outstanding stock. KL.
Royal companies are doing great. You have the large ones are doing great because they're more leveraged to the actual price of gold. And juniors have still not participated, which is rare when you see gold prices go higher. Usually juniors outperform everybody else. So I'm just giving that as an example. But I'm seeing that across a lot of different sectors where some companies are missing and some, you know, you look at semiconductors, Texas Instruments bombed the quarter. Intel blew out the numbers. AMD was okay. So you're seeing separation out there. Micron was okay. So when you're looking at it, it's not everything's going up no matter what. And that's something I like to see. So yes, I do think stocks are going to go up, but there's really a lot of opportunities right now that I'm seeing, surprisingly, because, you know, the market's really been driven higher by a select, you know, maybe 10, 15 different stocks. But there's a lot of good names out there that are seeing earnings growth that are trading at a cheap multiple and, you know, have good management teams and, you know, they're going to be buying back their stock, which, you know, we talk about this all the time, Andrew. We've been talking about this for 7, 8, 9 years, whatever. We've been doing podcasts together. It doesn't matter how you grow earnings.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Like people say, well, you buy back. It doesn't. And the reason why I'm telling you that is because I was wrong. And I was like, well, look at these buybacks. They didn't buy. We talked about that. They didn't buy back stuff. They didn't announce they were going to raise a dividend, but they did. And that's why you're looking at the banks where they're buying 20% of their floats because of the current laws is they're not allowed to lend the money that they have out. You know, they have the strongest they've been in the history of our country. And what are they doing? Well, okay, we can't do anything. Well, we're going to raise our dividend. We're going to buy back, you know, over a 3-year period. Citigroup, they're in their second year, is buying back 20% of their float. And these stocks are doing fantastic now.
It's amazing. It's a remarkable. And you have to wonder just on a simple mathematics process, where the end of that is, right? Is there an end to this process? There's only a certain amount of shares outstanding. And, you know, are they going to do it and bring back all their shares? And then what happens, in fact, if, I don't know what, the company needs money in the future in tougher times, and there's a lot less liquidity out there, and they do an offering, dilute the shares dramatically, right? Is it going to be a big problem for those companies? I mean, again, we don't know these answers because we are in times. I've been doing this for 25, 30 years or, you know, even though I'm only 22 years old, you know, obviously. But but the thing is that, you know, this is something much different. I mean, every decade has something different going on. And this is going to be the first decade, by the way. We only have about 60 days left or so of this decade. This is the first decade that we have not had a recession. That's pretty amazing.
It is. It is remarkable. I mean, you know, we've had measures in place, although, what happened 10 years ago or, you know, around 10 years ago, we've had, a market event that didn't happen in 80 years in our country.
Right.
And that's what we came off of. So, you know, when you put that in perspective, it's been going on for a long time, this bull market. but the numbers are still there. You don't want to fight those trends. You know, when you have low interest rates, it encouraged borrowing. People like to cite the debt. I'm a student of the markets, and historically, people have been talking about our debt problems, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Forget about the debt. It's not a risk. The only thing you need to know about debt is, are we paying it on time? Right. We are paying it on time. Right.
Yeah, and companies, and to that point, companies have more debt on their books than they've ever had before at lower interest rates that they had.
Even Microsoft with great balance sheets because it's so easy to borrow money. And that's the other thing. The other thing is low interest rates, which we have. And listen, if that blows up, we'll see it. Credit default swats, the bond market. We'll see the signs that the banks get audited, turned upside down every single year with the stress test. We'll see it happen. But debt's not the concern here. So, you know, as long as we have interest rates and everyone's paying it on time, but people continue to borrow and spend, and maybe this will blow up. And everybody always says that who's bullish. You know, I'm bullish now. This is going to blow up one day. That's what they've been saying in the 80s and 90s. Maybe it will. I don't know when. But if I'm looking at a 1-3 year period, it's, you know, the market environment, it's ripe right now for stocks to go higher.
You know, it's interesting because a couple of things. You know, we do that stock screen for one of our strategies where we look for earnings growth and we look for revenue growth and we look for expanding margins, all this good stuff, okay? There's a lot of things that go in there. Over the last two quarters, and we just did a rebalance recently, out of the 5,000 stocks, you got to kind of skim some of the basic stuff off the top to begin with. So let's say it's 4,500 stocks that are out there that we start the screening process with. Only 33 stocks made it through that screen again just last week. And it's interesting to me that I've seen that we've had as high in his historical reference of about 60 or 70. And now we're only at 30, meaning that, you know, people are giving growth an easier pass. They're allowing for things to be bought. And it looks like, all things being considered, that there is a bit of, as I've been saying, but calling it, you know, Momo meets FOMO. Where we've had momentum that's going on. People have been in cash and taking money out of the market. We know that equity investors have been removing money from the market for the last several months. And there's a lot of concern about, hey, are we getting toppy in the market? Is the, you know, interest rates going to be a problem? We see the slowdown, all the things that we know about, right? All the things, trade war, blah, 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 blah. And we had this momentum. And I think people have finally capitulated. And that's why I was looking today. I was doing a course today on some technical indicators. And I looked at the Bollinger Band, which is a measure of standard deviation above or below a particular moving average. And the Bollinger Bands that I was looking at was the 50-day moving average and two standard deviations above the above the 50-day moving average. And the S&P is trading above that. I haven't seen that in I can't tell you how long. And one of the things that you like to look at, and you showed me this first, by the way, was the fear-greed indicator by CNN, right?
Yeah, it's a really cool indicator, and it just puts a lot of the indicators, the technical indicators, or that try to measure sentiment, right? And sentiment's one of the most important things. It's one of the things I look at when I recommend stocks. We'll talk about a stock later that reported Disney. I think hopefully we get to that. But just you know, my calls on Apple have been when everyone's leaning to one side. Like right now, they're all leaning incredibly bullish, and their estimates are to have monster growth over the next 2 years. I just don't see it. I mean, they're not even growing revenue year over year. I mean, the iPhone sales have declined 9% year over year, and the stock's at an all-time high. Yep. But with this, when you're looking at sentiment, it has, you know, put and call options. It would have, you know, measures the breadth of the market momentum, stock price strength, junk bond demand, of course, the VIX as well. And it puts it all into one index and rates it from 1 to 100, one being extreme fear, which is a contrarian indicator you're supposed to be buying, right?
And then. But that's the point. It is a contrarian indicator oftentimes.
It's a contrarian indicator because when everyone's leaning on one side, you want to do the opposite. That's the point of this. But now the fear and greed index, it's 89. I saw a couple days ago. I
mean, 91 today.
I can't remember it being that high. And
I looked at the history of this. It was like 2015 or 17, 2017. It was right after the election and when they announced the tax benefits, I believe it was.
Yes. And this is a short-term indicator telling you that, listen, we're overbought right now. I mean, the stocks have gone up tremendously over the past 6 weeks. It's amazing how 6 to 8 weeks ago, there was a recession. You got to watch out. And yep. Dow crashed 800 points when we had an inverted yield curve for about 7 seconds. And it's all now no more. Now everyone's bullish. No recession. It's the greatest market ever. But, you know, that's just from watching TV. It's a lot of fun. They have a 24-hour news cycle that they have to, you know, fill.
It's more like a 5-minute news cycle that they have to fill.
That they just keep replaying.
It's unbelievable. And you know what? The thing is, talk about things like, it's funny because a lot of the guys on the television, particularly some of the financial particularly the financial shows, they've had the constant discussion of this one indicator, which is interesting, RSI. RSI, that, you know, oh, it's overbought, you got to buy it, right? And when it's over, when it's oversold, you got to buy it. When it's overbought, they're like, oh, okay, you know, it's getting a little high there. But you know what? The S&P is now about a 70, which is the top end once again that we've seen in a long time. The NASDAQ is the same thing. A lot of stocks are in the same area. But yet they're not going to tell you that, oh, it's, you know, a problem time. But if you look at the fear greed index, you look at a divergence in the McClellan, which is basically advanced decline kind of discussion. If you look at the toppiness of a Spearman, if you look at the Bollinger Bands on the 50-day, if you look at this fear and greed index, you know what? It wouldn't be surprising if 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now or whatever the time period is, that I'd come back and say, you know what? That was pretty obvious that things were overdone. But when you're in it, you know, when you're inside of it, it's not as easy to discern, right?
No, it's not. I mean, because your emotions get involved, even if you're a great investor. So, you know, you see this, and then yet, you know, for me, some of my biggest holdings are Intel and AT&T, which I've done very well with. Even now, I'm inclined to take profits a little bit, and yet I'm looking at it going, man, these things had nice run-ups, though. I mean, this thing could continue. So it's always, you know, this is an indicator, and it could change drastically in a week and a half from now and then, you know, be okay. But just, you know, when you're looking at all of these indicators together, which was why I like the CNN one, and it's for free. I don't get paid by them or nothing. It's the Fear and Greed Index.
Yeah, where right.
It puts everything
into
one.
You make so much money from CNN, it's not funny.
Yeah, oh, they pay me so much on the side. Yeah. But, so those are the indicators that I like to look at.
So now in the big scheme of things, we both, I think, agree that markets are a little, they may have some froth in it right now. That, again, that doesn't mean necessarily that the end of the world is near and we're going to fall off a cliff, which, again, wouldn't surprise me if we had a bit of a pullback here to kind of alleviate some of the extra froth. That's all I'm saying, right? I think we both agree with that. It wouldn't be a surprise, but not necessarily the longer term picture. That's what you're saying.
No, and I don't think you need to sell and then jump back in again. Right. So I don't see that. And it could be, it's going to be a great time to get back in again if you are selling a little bit, if you feel a little cautious here. When we decline by maybe 5 or 7%, all the bears on TV are just going that debt's going to go. Here comes a recession again. That's usually the time to buy.
I got to tell you though, I think if you really look back on what happened the last quarter of last year, I think a lot of it really had to do with, there's multitude of things, right? It's the whole trade war thing. It's, you know, what was going on there and the concern about that. And then the automatic pilot that the Fed was on at the time, that was really a concern by everybody saying that, oh my God, they're just going to raise rates forever. Is that really going to happen? Oh my God. So, I think it's pretty interesting that where we are now, and what you like is the bigger large cap dividend kinds of quote unquote blue chips, Ford, IBM, Intel. So let's talk about Ford for a second, because this is a interesting company, which is obviously recently in their quarterly report, pretty much threw everything in the basket of this sucks and having a lot of problems in a variety of areas. I think they saw a big slowdown in China, if I'm not mistaken, some problems there. What is it that you like about Ford?
I think I may be the only guy on the planet that likes Ford.
No, I like Ford too. I personally own Ford. Oh, I personally own Ford. Yep.
Okay, cool. Because, well, you know, I've got the same arguments with AT&T. I've been told they go to zero. Their debt is enormous, $200 billion, but nobody talks about the $30 billion in free cash flow they generate every single year. Nobody wants to
bet. Wait, AT&T really has $200 billion of debt?
Of debt, yeah. $200 billion. Well, they're lowering it now. They're selling assets, and now, you know, their leverage is coming down, and it isn't even that bad. So, but they do have a lot of debt. It's a very big company, but they have a nonstop revenue stream for wireless. And same with IBM. IBM was a company I hated at $200. We recommend it at 115, 116, it's 135. You know, you have to look at these companies and say, what's going on with them? The problems that existed, are they not going to exist in a couple of months? And, you know, same with Intel as well. I mean, Intel, AMD was eating their lunch. And, you know, it was, but Intel's trading at 11 times, 10 times forward earnings, a great dividend, 3, 4, 5% yields. So you're looking at this area of the market where everybody's craving yields, interest rates are coming lower. And for me, I like Ford because when I look under the hood, everybody talks about Ford declining cars. Yeah, I know that story. That's why it went down from 12 to 8. I get it. I understand it. But now it's at 8. What people aren't looking at is how many catalysts where this may be the leading technology company in the auto space. That's how much they've invested in technology over the past 4 or 5 years. One of the divisions is worth over $3 billion. They're going to be in driverless vehicles, electronic vehicles. And not only that, they're switching their whole strategy because nobody buys cars anymore. When I say nobody, most people. But they're going into trucks and crossovers. And that's their market right now. You're looking at their international divisions have all turned. They're all doing positive now. You had the CEO come in, and this isn't like a 10% owner hedge fund. This is the CEO coming in. I follow this stuff when it comes to insider buys. $8 million he bought. $8 million. That's a monster insider buy by an individual, right? So for me, that guy, and the stock's down about probably about 10% since he bought that. There's one event that we have to worry about, which is they got to renegotiate with their union, just like
things were going pretty well with that.
Yeah, they always are until they're not. What the headlines say. It's just like everyone's rolling back tariffs. Wait, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. So I think after that hurdle, and I don't think it's going to be that big because I'm hearing the same thing. Negotiation is not going to be a GM thing. But after that, I mean, here's a company set up to have earnings growth going forward. All these technological investments are going to be making money. They have a lot of hidden value in it. And this is a company that's going to start growing pretty soon. But people just look at it and say, Ford, holy cow. But if you look at their trucks, their lineups, their crossovers, these guys are doing the right thing. And this transition has been in the works for about 4 years, 5 years, just like IBM, right? IBM, oh, they're terrible. They're horrible. The legacy businesses. And well, now, big data analytics, they just bought Red Hat. They're going to be the largest hybrid cloud company in the world, which is a $1 trillion industry.
Red Hat's a great company. And that buy, which may have been, frankly, a little bit too expensive, is a very good thing for them. I mean, Red Hat, one of the fascinating things about Red Hat is it's a company that took a free product and made billions of dollars off of it. Linux Fortnite. Is free. What's that?
Fortnite. Same thing.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So Fortnite did the same thing. They gave it to everyone in the world, and then they just said, hey, if you want to upgrade this and you want to upgrade that, and now they're generating $300 million a month.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's unbelievable.
That's the model. Give it away for free and then charge them later.
So what's happening, though, with the semis? I know you mentioned Intel earlier. So the semis, you would think that with all this stuff going on with trade war and tariffs and all that, I mean, they started really breaking out a couple of months back significantly, right? I mean, again, some were better than others, but it was really concerned by the investment community for some time that the whole trade war and all that's going on, slowdown in Asia and in Europe, was really going to impact them. How do these semiconductors companies, particularly like an Intel, how do they really get beyond that? How do they do so well?
It depends what market you're in. I mean, a lot of these guys, some of them have tons of exposure to Huawei, the China situation, how to move operations, and supply chains because, there's just so much uncertainty based on what Trump wants to tweet that day or that week. And it depends, autonomous vehicles have been a booming market. If you're focusing on that, that's Mobileye, a division that Intel bought, paid a ton of money because they were late to the party.
That was beautiful. Yep.
There
was
years ago.
And there's actually something just a couple of days ago that somebody's doing some with, Neo. Neo is going to deal with Mobileye for autonomous driving. And the stock of Neo is up 40% in 2 days. And it's still under three, but that's another point.
I could tell you something about chip sector too. If you want the ultimate gauge, one company, Taiwan Semi. Taiwan Semi is the company. They make the chips for 80% of the companies out there. Intel has their own fab facilities. But if you pull up a 6-month chart of Taiwan Semi, just look at it. That's going to tell you that the semis are in good shape.
Right. Is that symbol TSM, right?
TSM, yes. But if you look at that, it's a beautiful chart, especially over the past 3 months. It's a beautiful chart going higher. But there are companies that are leveraged to a lot of things going in China, and they've gotten smoked. Texas Instruments, I have no idea. I looked at that quarter. Every one of the divisions declined. It wasn't even any catalysts were mentioned. I was like, wow, this is a really bad quarter. They just didn't get it done. I wanted to know if it was company specific, right, as an investor, or is this industry specific? It's company specific, and a lot of the chip companies are some of the ones doing are good, and that's why I talked about earlier. I'm finally seeing separation in these industries, which we haven't really seen. We've always seen all the chips go up, and then they come down sometimes. Now you're seeing separation here, and I like that.
It's interesting. I mean, because we've seen that also, that certain sectors getting obliterated. As just a weird example, I guess these businesses that have very low barriers to entry, where, it's a great idea and it takes off, like home food delivery. Listen, I delivered pizza on campus when I was in college because there wasn't anybody delivering pizza. you'd have to either go down to the pizza place on campus and get your pizza, or you weren't getting it. I'm like, you know what? To the pizza guy, do you think I could start a little program? Oh, sure. Now, obviously, I was way ahead of my time with the Grubhub thing, but we have Grubhub and we have delivery dudes and we have Postmates and we got all the restaurants still delivering and all that. And it's interesting, if you watch the stocks, they really did well. Everybody was really excited about this for a while. Then they just fell down. I mean, not only fell down, they got obliterated. The same thing with several other of these ideas where they started getting in and getting hot and getting excited. One of the big things right now, I'm leading into something here. One of the things that we've been seeing, of course, is the next generation of excitement in the area of, or continuation of this, streaming. And streaming, yes. Of course, we have Netflix. Reed Hastings, who took on the idea of, hey, you know what? Instead of going, well, what was he? He was a delivery service too, if you think about it. I mean, what? That's what Netflix was. It was Blockbuster, but that delivered it to you, right? That's exactly what he did. So I guess I guess all these great ideas are for the laziness in all of us. But now,
if you look back at a lot of these companies that are so successful, I mean, they're successful. Look at Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft is cloud. It's a cloud company now. I mean, it was a Windows company back in the day. Right. They still generate Windows, but without cloud, they wouldn't have went from 30 to 100 and something, and they had a 12-year period. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you slip onto things and they work out, and that's what happened with Netflix. And a lot of businesses, you could say, wow, you know, they weren't created based on the model they have today. They were created for something else.
Now, before I talk about the streaming, I want to mention something here. One of the reasons that many of these companies are so successful right now is because they switched over. I think one of the first ones that I remember going on from a technology standpoint, going on a subscription service was Adobe. Everybody's like, oh, I ain't going to work. You know, who's going to be paying monthly? You know, I had my Adobe product, my Adobe suite. I paid whatever it was, $1,000. I held on to it till the last second till I had to get the new one and upgrade. Why would somebody want to keep paying this? I don't want to even pay the original price. But they were very successful at transitioning to a subscription, software as a service concept. Then we had Microsoft, or not in any particular order, we had Microsoft do it. And of course, you have other ones like a Netflix and in the streaming that has this kind of subscription process. This, I want to get to something way outside of this discussion now. This is why the employment report is so important each and every month. The more people that you have working, the more people you need for seats. Salesforce gets more revenue because you have more people that need the product. Microsoft, you got to put on a new desk possibly, and somebody needs a new Windows system or cloud base or new Teams account. You go along all the way. Same thing with Adobe, same thing with Netflix. You know, as long as people are working, they're paying their subscriptions. This whole subscription process, tell me if I'm wrong, Frank, has not been tested in a downtrend.
No, it hasn't been. But there's a big separation what you're talking about, because when you have Adobe and you have Microsoft, it's not just subscription services; it's the cloud capabilities behind that as well.
That's
what makes that. When it comes to streaming, I have to tell you, and I mean, I think Disney's a big short here, and I might be in an island by myself.
Whoa.
And I'm gonna go into streaming.
Disney is a big short. He just said that. Yeah, he kind of glossed over that for a second. He said Disney is a big short, and then he said Disney is a big short. We're going to ask why that is. Go ahead, Frank.
Well, let's get to the streaming part.
Go ahead.
There is not a – and you brought up a good point earlier. You said, hey, all these companies that do these little things like Uber Eats, I'll throw GoPro in there. I'll throw Fitbit in there. I'll throw iRobot in there. So I go to Consumer Electronics Show every year. It's been held second week in January for the last 8 years. And I saw iRobot. I saw there was 30 competitors there that had cheaper things, and they were better. They were climbing walls, cleaning windows. These machines. They were the same. I was like, they're dead. That means there's low barriers of entry, and they have no pricing power. Fitbit got lucky because Google has no more innovation, so they decided to purchase Fitbit instead of starting by itself. They'll waste $2 billion of their 100, whatever it is. iRobot went to 130. Now it's 50. And you're looking at GoPros. It's kind of a dead company, which, you know, it's a good company, but they have tons of the same products, 360 cameras. Now, when I look at streaming and throwing streaming in there, there's not a company. It's when you look at a GoPro, Fitbit, these are all great services for you, for me, for everyone listening to this. They're horrible business models for the companies, just like streaming. There's not a company that has made money doing streaming. Mm-hmm. And if you try to do a discounted cash flow model on, and I won't get too, you know, crazy with numbers, on Netflix, or even have them do it, they don't have them making money forever. Like in the next 7 years, forever, they're not going to make money. So
when
I look at Hulu losing $1.5 billion, and now Disney controls most of Hulu, they AT&T stake, and then they bought Fox's assets. But everyone's going all into this industry, and I feel like it's like you going to a basketball game and getting front row seats for $10 and being able to shake LeBron's hand and get free food and free drinks and free everything, which is the greatest thing in the world for you. It's horrible for the Lakers. This is a terrible business model. It's a horrible business model where Disney just went out and spent $71 billion on Fox's entertainment assets, which, by the way, they were trying to pay about. That deal was supposed to go in early 2018, and they were talking about $60, $62 billion. They paid $70, I think it's $73 billion in total with debt. And you're going to try to make that up selling services for $6.99. And yes, you'll be able to leverage that content, and I know they're going to shove the little dolls down kids' throats. I get it. And remake everything, but
and you bought all them. You bought all them, by the way.
Listen, when it comes to streaming, by the way, it's a money losing business, and it's extremely expensive. So Disney's right now is going all in a desperate way because this was desperation for them. And when I look at this quarter, it wasn't a good quarter. When you're highlighting, the quarter was okay. Yeah, we beat earnings. We didn't really beat revenue. And it's the first company I know of that didn't offer guidance. They didn't offer earnings guidance, and it went up. I don't know any major companies that do that anymore. If they'd say, they didn't offer guidance.
Well, because they talked about the streaming, and they talked about how great it's going to be.
Oh, yeah.
And the launch and Disney Plus and blah, blah, blah.
I mean, look, this isn't me just ranting. This is me doing a ton of research on this where we talked about buybacks earlier, how big a part of the market it is. Well, Disney bought back in 2016 close to $10 billion, 2017, $12 billion, 2018 around $6 billion, $7 billion. They suspended their buybacks. Why?
Well, they needed the money to buy Fox.
They needed the money to buy Fox, and the amount of debt that they took on is incredible. I mean, you cover it. Last year, they had $20 billion in debt. They have $60 billion in debt, and that $20 billion was at an interest rate of 2.5%. This $60 billion is more like 6%.
Really?
So put it in perspective. Oh,
because the Fox debt?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, put this in perspective. Next year alone, I mean, if you throw everything in, like the debt, which includes capital leases, operating leases, their payment next year is $9 billion on their debt. The next 2 years is going to be $8 billion and $8 billion. The next 5 years, $37 billion is due, and it carries around a 6% interest rate. And if we want to put the $9 billion in perspective, their net income for this year is going to be about $9.5 billion and also $9.5 billion next year.
But they'll be able to refinance the debt at Disney's numbers now, not Fox's, right?
Well, they just took out the debt. You refinance the debt, they're going to look at their numbers again. But they're going to – when it comes to the streaming market, for them to pay that much money – if you look at Hulu and look in this quarter that they just announced, Hulu lost $700 million. Hulu. They lost $700 million. How long has Hulu been out for?
Yep.
How is this company not even close to make it? It's not even close. You know why? Because you have to spend a fortune, and it's not the content that makes streaming work. People are like, well, Disney's going to have so much content. AT&T has its original programming. That's why no one will ever need Netflix, Stranger Things, Orange is the New Black. You look at HBO, Session, whatever. People die where I need to watch this and I need to be on this platform, which forces you. It's going to be in a different environment. It's going to be a pressured environment to constantly come up with new content that not only costs billions and billions to produce. Just look at Netflix paying, what, $12, $13, $14, $15 billion a year. And now you got to market that content as well. And you wonder how tough it is. Apple didn't succeed. You look at Disney and mentioned the partnership with Amazon. Big deal. It's not like a partnership with their retail division, their cloud division. They're partnering in streaming, which Amazon's making zero money off of. So that was the highlight of the quarter. Oh, we partner with Amazon. But Amazon's terrible at this business as well. So when I look at streaming, I look at Disney and look at the previous quarter as well when they missed really bad and the stock fell, I think, 6%, 7%. That previous quarter, they had the Avengers. They had Toy Story 4. They had good results out of that park, and they still missed estimates. And Avengers was the highest grossing movie of all time, beating out Avatar. So when I look at Disney going forward, if you look at the earnings, right, because we talked about trailing 12 months, Andrew, we talked about forward earnings. The trailing 12 months is trading at 17 times forward earnings, which is a market multiple. The forward earnings are trading at 25 times. What does that mean? Earnings are going to decline considerably year over year. You want to pay 25 times earnings for a company that's going to see declining earnings, that's taking on this amount of debt, and basically the way they're going to make it up is charging $6.99. Now, you look at Hulu. Hulu has close to 30 million subscribers. And Disney says, well, we're going to have about 40 to 60 million subscribers in 2024. That's their estimates. And we're going to make money by then. There's zero chance. Zero that they're going
to
make money.
So why are they, if it's pretty obvious to you?
It's not obvious. I'm the only person that's talking about it. I haven't seen anybody mention.
Well, I mean, we know the problems that Netflix has. And Netflix, Reed Hastings was recently quoted as talking about spending more money on original content moving forward. And it's a bit of a churn game and a moving back and forth. And the other problem you didn't even mention is the more players that are on the platform, the streaming platform, the more you're going to see that there's going to be a fight for that dollar.
There's no pricing power.
Right.
The Disney's not actually gonna be able to raise
it's the inverse pricing power.
I mean, unless like there's sports franchise, ESPN is doing terrible, but that's, you know, the live program. But now you can go to YouTube and pay $49 a month, or I think it's $45 a month, and get every live sports game in any sport. Any sport. You go, you field hockey.
You badminton, can go any can you get badminton because I like badminton.
Badminton, everything.
Oh, fantastic. Every single
sport you can get for that. And that could be an add-on to your Netflix subscription. But yeah, if you have Roku, who's really killing it right now, because they are a platform that just all they have. If you, it's great because I have it. They just there's literally hundreds of streaming channels that people don't know about. Hundreds of them that just do documentaries or live music. I mean, it's amazing. Now, again, when we look at streaming, it's an exciting industry because it works for us. We love it. We don't have to pay high cable bills. People are cutting the cords, but there hasn't been a company yet that's shown that this business model works. And what makes me nervous about Disney is Netflix knows how to operate a company being in debt. So does Tesla. These guys are used to it. This is a different ballgame for Disney. They're not used to this. They're used to getting money, like tons of Hulu used to pay them a fortune, right? Because they have all this content they're licensing out no longer.
Right.
So now you got to spend, it's a different environment there. And to me, it's desperation. All the analysts are leaning one way. They're all buys, but there's a reason why the company, everybody thinks that quarter was great. I think it's two bad quarters in a row. And you took on $71 billion in debt. But there's a reason why the stock has sold off from its highs.
Right.
And I think now is a really good time to short. I was going to say, wait, you had momentum behind it. But the fact that it's coming down, people are looking at the numbers saying, you know what? These numbers really weren't that good. And I don't think they're going to be that good going forward because it's going to take a long time to build this business up. It's going to be a long time to focus on international subscribers, which is a much lower average revenue per user compared to domestically. So I'm not sold on Disney doing this move, going all in right now, taking on this amount of debt. I mean, they paid 25% of their market cap to buy Fox's entertainment assets. And man, they better hope that they really, really sell that content.
Yeah. Full disclosure here. We had shorted Roku into the earnings, closed it for an 18% profit the day after. Nice. So that was nice. So 2 week hold, 18% profit on that. We saw that the charts, that was a chart issue. And, you know, the stock was at 172, came down to about the 100 range. Yep. And then
it went to 150 before the quarter, right?
We shorted at 149 and bought it back at about 121 and a half, something like that. What else? So what else? Let's talk about some of the other drivers that are going on. I'm not going to talk to you this time. We're not going to spend any time. I'm telling you, we're not going to spend any time, except what I'm about to say, on any of this crappy trade deal Khazarai that's going on. I don't want to talk about it because I'm sick of it. I'm totally sick of it. So in terms of what's your thoughts on the small caps, generally speaking? So the small caps have been a laggard, to say the least. Now, a lot of inside the small cap universe, there's a lot of small banks, there's some energy companies. What is going on in the small caps? Is it something else that is different in terms of how they're able to have their pricing and the operational playbook inside of this kind of market condition or economic condition?
I don't know if I'd go that deep into it, because when you look at the small cap market, it had the biggest discrepancy in terms of price against the S&P 500 in like 17 years. That's how much it underperformed. Usually when the market goes higher, small caps do better, but we had a lot of macro risks, right? Trade. And you could say, well, but trade, that's more about China. And these companies, you know, usually small caps don't get as they do most of their business in the US. And, you know, it's like 35% of profits for S&P 500 companies are international. But it was a risk off trade. And the short positions on some of these small caps were incredible. We did very well in small caps in my Curzio Venture Opportunity newsletter. And then the past 6 months, outside of this past month, because they're coming back a little bit, we've seen some of our names get hit, and they've gotten hit for no reason. They've reported good earnings, good everything, and it's just a matter of rotating this money into a lot of short positions with small caps, the rebalancing where they do it every June, I believe, and those companies get shorted immediately because there's a big inflow of cash to get the volatility and people just dump, you know, they sell the crap out of them. But right now, where we are with the markets going higher, the U.S. is doing good. I think it's a great time to get into small caps. It's one of the areas I'm finding great value in. And I'm not talking about getting aggressive and buying stocks at a dollar. I'm talking about good small caps that have billion, $2 billion market caps, you know, hundreds of million dollar market cap companies that you know, look
you're
really
not, attractive. You're not talking about the penny stocks.
No, I'm not talking about penny stocks. This is the Russell 2000. If you're like, you could start the Russell 2000. And it was, this was before the latest rally, but it was, I think it was something like, what, 55% of the companies were down with the market higher, yeah. You know? So when you're That's looking at saying. Small caps yeah. getting healed, it was surprising, but there's a lot of great companies that are just trading at cheap valuations that are growing earnings much faster than the overall market. Again, good management teams. And what I like to see as one component of the research that I do is just, you know, if your stock's down 20, 25% off its highs for literally no reason, I want to see the insiders buying. And we're starting to see that with a lot of small caps where insiders are buying and saying, wait, this is a joke. This is way too cheap.
So let me just give a summary of some of the discussion here. Number one, you think that, hey, you know what? The situation is set up well enough that even though there's some froth in the market, and that is shorter term conversation and a look at it, that longer term we're going to do a lot better. And potentially through next year, markets will generally do well. And there are certain stocks that you have thought of in Ford and IBM, Intel on the long side, Disney on the short side. So generally speaking, you're bullish on stocks in general. What particular thing keeps you up at night thinking, oh, I hope this goes right because there's a big component in all this? Don't say trade war. Don't say, because I'm not talking about that. Is there anything else?
Yeah, it's definitely the trade war.
Oh. No.
Oh. You know how I felt about the trade war? I thought it was a meaningless thing. It's up and down, up and down, up and down. If we look where we are now at all-time highs, I was saying this is going to get done. We're going to get a trade deal done. And you know, for 2 years, I've been shouting, saying, stop worrying about it. It's a non-factor. And I still think it's a non-factor because they both have to come to an agreement. It just makes sense for both of them. It's not debt that scares me at all, because you're going to be able to see that coming from a mile away. What really scares the hell out of me is the program trading. You know, we do continue to have flash crashes, algos mm-hmm. where, I mean, if you do a deep dive into this industry and what's going on, these guys are moving their infrastructure as close to New York Stock Exchange as possible to get a millisecond edge, which could mean the difference between millions in profits and millions of losses. Their indicators are not just, hey, what do we talk about today? We talked about insider buys, P ratios, you know, moving averages. I mean, these are like, what are, if Macy's crashes, what are the five other retailers that crash even more? And there's millions of data points in these systems, in these algorithms, and they're hiring not stock analysts, but they're hiring people from MIT who maybe make $100,000 mm-hmm. and say, hey, you go, here's $5 million. So you have all these systems. Now, what happened? You have Six Sigma, Renaissance Technologies. I mean, there's not enough money to go. These guys are showing no losses, right? They're front running the market, looking at everything. It's not, they're not buying IBM because or Apple because of earnings. They're looking at the trading orders and getting it before everybody else.
Yeah, how great is that?
That is great, but that's perfectly fine, right? I guess that's legal. Okay. That's perfectly fine. Yeah. Now, they have so much money, they can't take any more, right? They have uh-huh. $150 billion plus Renaissance. You look at a Six Sigma. But now you have these copycat firms that are trying to do the same thing and piling on. And that's why you're seeing in earnings season when a company – I mean, look at this earnings season. Just the past couple of days, I can't tell you how many stocks are up or down, more than 15%.
Yep.
Tons of them. Yep. Tons. And they'll go up. They'll
Party City hit 65% down.
Oh, it's insane. But for me – if these systems crash, it's going to trigger an event unlike anything that we've ever seen.
When you say crash, and you mean like somebody pulls the plug out or they so just get their orders?
Look at 2010. A guy, you know, whatever he did. It was a trade. I don't know if he leaned on a button or whatever. And it caused, what was it, 1,000%? Essentially went from 40 to zero back to 40 uh-huh. in like a minute.
Right.
Procter & Gamble lost 40% of his value. We have circuit breakers in place. I don't think it's going to be enough. I don't think it's going to, with the amount of volume and trading, which is what is 85, 90% of it, where all these systems, they're starting to piggyback each other, kind of like what we saw in the housing market, right? The housing market, why the housing market crashed? It didn't crash because of subprime loans. No, that was nothing. It was because they leveraged them 40 times.
Right.
Because everybody kept saying, wow, we could just pool these things together. And then the credit agencies, we could pay them off and they're going to give us AAA ratings and we can get high yields on this. Holy cow. And if shit hits the fan, we'll get this stuff insured at AIG. And then AIG said, oh, well, we're not going to insure it. And it almost killed the whole entire system because everybody jumped on the same everybody's jumping on this strategy right now. And that's one of the things that keeps me up.
But when it comes to that, I think we have to bring up the zero commission discussion, because this is part of the reason why companies like Schwab and TD, and name your company out there, can actually go to zero commission, because they're selling orders to these other folks that are paying them for the order flow. Is that going to possibly be even a higher concern, because now they're really pushing a lot towards that avenue?
I think this is a very dangerous move, right? So you have Charles Schwab coming out. You had Robinhood, who's like a smaller platform, no fees. And then Charles Schwab came out. And then the rest of the industry is like, oh, shit, we have to do this. This is a big part of their revenue. It's a big part of their earnings. Like, they're taking charges on this right now. Now, they have to try to make up the earnings.
Well, that's what I'm concerned about.
Like, so what did E-Trade do back in the credit crisis? HELOC loans like crazy. Nobody knew that about E-Trade. Yep. So what are these guys going to do? You could say, well, they'll do this. No, they would be doing that right now if they can make money off it. Now they have to find ways to make money, which usually means you're going to get more aggressive, more risky. That's what scares me about trading, where this is a big component. This is how they make money. And now they just pull it all. And I get it, just to better compete. But what is that going to lead to? It might not lead to anything this year or next year, but these guys are going to have to do some crazy stuff to make up that part of the earnings. And I'm going to be paying close attention to their calls, because, you know, E-Trade snuck how much billions and billions in those HELOC loans that they're generating tons of interest, tons of money off of from those rates. And it almost crashed that whole entire company. Thank God.
And the other thing that I think it's going to do is going to create some other product of some sort that they're going to try to push down the throat of their clients, whether it's proprietary trading vehicles that they're utilizing inside of some kind of a robo freebie deal, or some other kind of, I don't know, high commission insurance that's embedded in the back end and annuities. I don't know what it's going to be, but it does concern me as well. So that's something that I think that dovetails into your discussion about the high frequency trading, because I think that has allowed for these. If it wasn't for them, they couldn't go to zero commissions.
No. And we, you know what, with the high frequency, we don't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's
and
all black box.
Our regulatory authorities aren't like, and that's what happened with the credit crisis. Nobody, everyone was asleep at the wheel, even though there's a lot of, you know, everybody called the credit crisis that by now, you know that, right? Everyone called.
I had it in the 1980s. I knew it was going to come.
But it's funny when, you know, you're looking at the measures in place, and that's why we have stress tests on banks, but we have nothing on these guys, and the biggest funds in the world, we talk about trillions of dollars being influenced by them every day, all of them leaning and you know, these trigger events. Remember, we're talking about computers here. We're not talking about people that could solve problems. We're talking about computers that have not really been tested during huge bear markets. And if something happens, that's one of the things that worries me, because we really know very, very little about that industry, and it accounts for most of the trading on all the exchanges.
Yeah, I hear you. Frank Curzio from CurzioResearch.com. You can go over there and check out all the different things that he has to offer, as well as his amazing podcast, where he has some of the best guests. I should know it. I've been on it. I'm one of the lower guys. But you can check him out over there. And, of course, I want to mention that we have some great guests coming up. We have an expert in the area of ESG. ESG. And if you don't know what that is, well, you know what? Tune in next week, and you're going to learn all about it. And the following week, I know somebody that Frank recently had on was Meb Faber. He's coming on the show as well, talking about factoring, ETFs, home country bias. I know those are some of the things that he likes to talk about. So we're going to talk about that. Frank Curzio, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right. And everybody out there, we're going to see you again next week. Thanks for joining us. Make sure to check out all the information. We'll put the Fear and Greed Index indicator in the show notes, as well as all the information on how to get in touch with Frank as well. Until next week, I'll see you soon. Thanks a lot. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.